This is Barbara Leslie, President of the Oakland Port Commission. Oakland International Airport, OAK, is proud to bring you this podcast of KQED's Forum. When you're choosing your next adventure, the smart and convenient choice is to fly the East Bay Way from OAK to destinations across the USA and Mexico. And when you return home, tune in to KQED, always bringing us remarkable stories about who we are and where we live. Enjoy today's episode of Forum.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Alexis Madrigal. The latest edition of the world's most important climate negotiations got underway yesterday in Glasgow. It's the UN Climate Change Conference of Parties 26th meeting, known by climate watchers simply as COP26. The basic politics of climate have been shifting, tilting the world closer towards the kind of action most scientists believe must occur. But at this particular moment, energy prices are also rising, a consequence of the shock the pandemic sent through the global economy. And in the U.S., gas prices are the highest they've been since 2014. Given our national politics, maybe Washington is not where we should be looking for leadership. Maybe California has a role to play on the world stage. That's coming up next. Welcome to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. There are certainly places that have felt the effects of climate change more acutely than California, island nations, for example. But in our area, especially here in the north where devastating wildfires have hit our state over and over and over, we know that there's a lot at stake. That said, even as we possess one of the largest economies in the world, we do not have the same seat at the table as France or India. Governor Gavin Newsom, like Jerry Brown before him, has pushed more aggressive climate policies than the Democrats' national leadership, and he was supposed to lead our state delegation to Glasgow before he pulled out somewhat inexplicably late last week. COP21, where the Paris Agreement was struck, felt like something of a civilizational milestone. Will Glasgow? COP26's organizers wrote, "Paris set the destination, limiting warming well below 2 degrees, aiming for 1.5 degrees. Glasgow must make it a reality." Today we ask, what could real global action mean for California? And what, if anything, can California's policies show the world? We're joined by David Victor, a professor of innovation and public policy in the School of Global Policy and Strategy at UC San Diego, also an adjunct professor in climate, atmospheric science, and physical oceanography at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. He'll be attending COP26. Welcome to the show, David Victor.
Great to be with you.
We also have Rachel Becker, who's covering this very closely for the excellent publication Cal Matter. She's their environment reporter. Welcome, Rachel.
Hi, thank you.
And we have Michael Mendez, assistant professor in the School of Social Ecology at UC Irvine and author of Climate Change from the Streets, How Conflict and Collaboration Strengthen the Environmental Justice Movement, and will also be attending COP26. Welcome, Michael. All right, Rachel, let's start with you. We know that Governor Newsom was planning to attend. Then he decided to stay home. Does it shift anything fundamental in how the state is approaching this big global event?
No, it really depends on who you ask. You know, I've heard some disappointment that the governor won't be there, with one climate advocate saying that COP26 desperately needs an injection of ambition, which he said Governor Newsom could have provided. Others, though, have said that what's much more important than the speech making is Governor Newsom's actions at home. So, you know, really mixed reactions. But California's contingent has, you know, repeatedly said that they're going to put their best foot forward, led by Lieutenant Governor Eleni Kounalakis, and have really voiced their confidence in the Lieutenant Governor's capabilities at this conference.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the question is, this seemed like a real kind of political slam dunk for Newsom. He just kind of had to show up and be involved in this major climate summit. Do we know why he pulled out?
So on Friday was the about face about Governor Newsom's plans, with the governor's office announcing that he would not be attending, quote, due to family obligations and would instead be participating virtually. But the governor's office would not provide any other details. Two sources who weren't authorized to speak publicly, however, told us that he did not have any plans to make any major announcements at the conference and had privately questioned his purpose in attending. So, you know, we're waiting for the governor to weigh in on this, but that's where it stands.
Gotcha. Thank you. David Victor, the G20 countries and big economies of the world met before COP26 got started. Did any of the things they discussed or worked out change the situation for COP26?
They don't really change COP26. You know, I think just to pick up on what Rachel was saying, at best, these COP meetings set a direction. They have a consensus agreement. There are lots of speeches. The G20 meetings over the last 2 days in Rome led to a communique that reinforced the purpose of the COP, emphasized the need to stop warming at 1.5 degrees, an ambitious goal that's essentially impossible to achieve, and kind of continue the momentum. But beyond that, it didn't really get much done. I think we're going to see over the next couple of weeks more concrete actions and promises being made at COP and so on. But really, almost all the action happens on the ground, real people doing things, you know, places like California, companies doing things. And that's not going to be done by a consensus committee, whether it's in Glasgow or Rome or any other place.
Yeah. And we're going to get to that, some of the shifts in how climate politics have really started to work over the last few years. Michael Mendez, this is your first time heading to COP, and you've been deeply involved in environmental justice movement, tracking it. What do you hope to get out of going to Glasgow and hope to see there?
Good morning. Yes, I'm currently actually in Scotland today. I got in last night. I'm really enthusiastic about seeing the ways in which NGOs and Native American tribes, Indigenous tribes, and other groups really focused on community-based solutions and environmental justice or climate justice, of how they're representing their own values and worldviews at this global and elite conference that brings together 120 world leaders that are trying to commit to more comprehensive and equitable forms of climate action, both globally and locally.
I mean, just on like a kind of practical human basis, like what do you expect to actually do? Like, you know, how are you going to fill your days there?
Well, attending as an observer, attending some of the official meetings, the press conferences. Currently, the Biden administration has a press conference, and I was watching on the special advisor, Gina McCarthy, talk about equitable approaches to climate action. But also, it's an opportunity for networking, both, you know, from the policymaker side, but also from the activist NGO side. So there's also side events and parallel events that are focused on these issues, climate justice and people-centered approaches to climate change. So I've attended other global meetings, particularly ones that California have led, and going to the parallel side meetings have been most fruitful, and to understand the different perspectives from around the world that they individuals bring to climate change, particularly since California is a global leader and often thinks of itself as a nation state and participating at that global stage with countries like Germany and France.
Yeah. We're talking about the big 2021 UN climate change meeting, COP26, which began Sunday with Michael Mendez, a professor in the School of Social Ecology at UC Irvine, David Victor, professor of innovation and public policy in the School of Global Policy and Strategy at UC San Diego, and Rachel Becker, an environment reporter at Cal Matters. And we would like to hear from you. I mean, how do you think California can be a model for global climate policy? What work should California prioritize to reduce our carbon footprint? Give us a call now, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or you can email your comments to forum@kqed.org. David Victor, when we talk about what's supposed to really happen at this conference, you know, making the destination that Paris set into a reality, you know, what have governments been doing in the years between Paris and now?
Well, mostly they've been trying to deal with climate change issues back at home and figuring out what they're willing and able to implement. And that's exactly as it should be. The only way we're really going to make progress is if, you know, governments and firms go make investments, run experiments, figure out what's possible. And at the COP itself, they've been making a whole series of pledges over the last year. And so the reason this is a big deal, this COP, is because this is the first time since COP21 in Paris in 2015, when all governments have updated their pledges. So almost every government has come to this COP having already said, here are some new things we're going to do. Now, governments that account for about 70% of world emissions have announced that they are going to stop emissions, net zero emissions, by mid-century, almost all of them by the year 2050, China by the year 2060. And so there's been a kind of huge refresh of those commitments, and that reflects a lot of serious work back at home over the last few years.
Yeah. But, you know, you said that the goal that was set out in Paris, I think that you described it as basically impossible, limiting warming to 1.5 degrees. That means that the current plans that are at, you know, in Glasgow don't really cut deeply enough to get there, right?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a glass is half full versus glass is half empty story. You're always going to have the goal is always going to be more ambitious than the governments themselves can deliver, because it's easy to set ambitious goals when you don't lay out in detail who has to do what. And so they all get together and say, we should stop warming well below 2 degrees was the formal goal set in Paris. And a lot of people are using 1.5 degrees as a benchmark. We're now at about 1.2 degrees and rising. So when you look at the inertia that's in the climate system, the heat that's already building up, carbon dioxide building up in the atmosphere, plus the inertia in the industrial system, there's no way to really turn that around quickly enough to stop warming at 1.5 degrees. But I guess the reason I see the glass is half full, or maybe a little more than half full, is because if you go back 10, 15 years and look at the worst case projections for the amount of warming we'd have, they were looking at 4 or 5 degrees of warming this century. And right now we're on track for 2.5 to 3 degrees of warming, maybe a little bit more. And that's still a whole lot of warming, bad impacts, you know, bad news. But it's not anything like what the worst case scenarios were before. And that's for a lot of reasons, but part of the reason is climate policy.
Yeah. And when we say a lot of reasons, I assume one thing is companies saying they're going to limit these emissions. One thing is China saying that they're going to, you know, voluntarily and nationally peak their emissions earlier than might have been projected. And another thing is the availability of this set of new technologies, right, for particularly in the power sector.
Yeah, and so the power sector is really crucial, because almost every study that looks at how do you make deep cuts in emissions across the economies comes to the conclusion that electrification is the centerpiece. There's a lot of dispute about how much are we going to electrify, when we electrify everything or only some of it. We're running a set of experiments here in California to look at different kinds of strategies. But there's been a tremendous amount of progress in the electric power sector, a lot in renewables, batteries, integration of renewables, the kind of list goes on and on and on. And I think that's one of the reasons why people are encouraged about the potential for big reductions in emissions, even if they're discouraged about the possibility of making cuts deep enough to stop warming at 1.5 degrees.
We're talking about the big 2021 UN climate change meeting, COP26, which began Sunday with David Victor, you just heard, professor of innovation and public policy in the School of Global Policy and Strategy at UC San Diego. He'll be attending COP26, part of the UC delegation. We've also got Rachel Becker, environment reporter with Cal Matters, and Michael Mendez, assistant professor in the School of Social Ecology at UC Irvine, and author of Climate Change from the Streets, How Conflict and Collaboration Strengthen the Environmental Justice Movement. And he's actually joining us from Scotland now. We want to hear from you. What's California's role in all of this? Give us a call now, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. Or email your questions to forum@kqed.org. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for more Forum after the break.
This is Barbara Leslie, president of the Oakland Port Commission. Oakland International Airport, OAK, is proud to bring you this podcast of KQED's Forum. When you're choosing your next adventure, the smart and convenient choice is to fly the East Bay Way from OAK to destinations across the USA and Mexico. And when you return home, tune in to KQED, always bringing us remarkable stories about who we are and where we live. Enjoy today's episode of Forum.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We are talking about the 2021 UN Climate Change Meeting, COP26. We're actually joined by Devin Murphy, a Pinole City Council member, literally, I think, at the airport right now on his way to Glasgow. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks for having me. How's it going this morning?
Good, good, good. So, good. You know, you're a Pinole councilman heading to this global meeting. I mean, what do you hope to get out of it?
A couple of things. Well, first and foremost, thank you so much for having me. I'm Devin Murphy. I'm a city council member in Buffalo Knoll. And frankly, you know, this conference is so important because on a number of reasons. But as a city councilor attending, I really look to and think that folks should look to small cities like mine of 20,000 who are on the front lines of the movement to combat the climate crisis and fighting for a clean energy future. You know, there's a lot of work that's being done around the globe, but it's really the small cities and small regions, right, that are driving inspiration, hope, and action. And so I'm excited to attend this week.
Yeah. So, I mean, give me the Pinole level look at global climate change. Sure. Like, you're looking at the budget, you're looking at, you know, your coastline there, you're looking at your water system. Like, what are Pinole's problems being caused by climate change?
Absolutely. That's a great question, and I love that question. So, you know, as I mentioned, I'm a council member of Pinole. We're a small city in the Bay Area, but we're about 15 minutes away from San Francisco. We are also a bayfront city impacted by issues like sea level rise, but we're also impacted by all the California wildfires happening in Northern California, as well as just being in the heart of Contra Costa County, one of the most industrial counties in the state of California. We're between a refinery and a natural gas facility. So obviously that impacts the air of our families and our children. And so in Pinole, you know, I've been focused on a number of issues. First and foremost, most importantly, is building resiliency hubs, right, for emergency operation situations. This includes having areas that, for example, when, you know, we've had a couple of these in the last year, when our air is not clean and we can't walk outside, we have somewhere where folks can go to have access to Wi-Fi, to have clean air, to have water, access to water. And utilizing our public spaces to do that is really critical right now. I've been focused largely on the issue of Wi-Fi, municipal Wi-Fi, right? When emergency operations happen, the folks who are hardest to reach need access to Wi-Fi in order to make sure they have the resources to survive. And if we don't do that as a city government, who will do it? But we're not stopping there, right? There's a huge push around electrification of new and old construction, natural gas appliances and that we've traditionally used, 40%. Increase children asthma rates by 40%. We've got to take a turn. And then lastly, like you mentioned, water is a huge important issue, right? The idea of recycled water. And in a drought where we're dealing with this in California, we've got to figure out ways to expand on wastewater treatment to ensure that we have recycled water for our community. So those are just some of the ways we're amplifying climate action in Pinole.
Last thing before we let you like walk down the jetway to your plane. Are there particular cities or is there like a network of small cities that you're hoping to kind of like link into as part of this, kind of climate networks?
Well, we're hoping to build that. And that's why I think it's so important. And like I said, I come from Pinole. I'm from a small city. I will be our mayor pro tem next year. And my hope is to build a network of elected officials who are focused not only on the attendance of COP26, but what happens after COP26 when we all come back home to our respective communities. We've got to build this community. We've got to build this network. And I think as much as we're relying on our global leaders to lead, we've got to rely on our local leaders to make sure to take action and steer the ship. So I'm excited to build that community together.
Devin Murphy, Pinole City Council member, getting on a plane to go to COP26 right now. Thanks so much for joining us.
Right now. Thank you so much for doing this. Have a great day.
See you later. We're talking about the big 2021 UN climate change meeting, COP26. Want to bring in the rest of our panel here. We're still joined by David Victor from UC San Diego, Rachel Becker, environment reporter with CalMatters, and Michael Mendez, assistant professor in the School of Social Ecology at UC Irvine. Rachel Becker, I want to talk about California's action, like our delegation that's going to COP26. What are they sort of presenting as like, okay, here's what California's done?
So, Jared Blumenfeld, who's California's top environmental official, told reporters Friday that the mission is exactly what you said, you know, to learn what other governments are doing to curb emissions, but also to teach, you know, bringing California's example of climate policies and regulations to other nations and subnational governments. And, you know, California does come to the conference with some real climate wins. You know, California reached its 2020 goals to cut greenhouse gas pollution to 1990 levels 4 years early. You know, we've seen the electricity sector really clean up under the renewable energy standards. And California's also got some pretty serious clean car rules. That said, you know, California does have some, you know, kind of climate black eyes that it's also bringing to the meeting with it, including, you know, that it's there have been real criticisms of California's cap and trade program, which we may hear from Professor Victor about. This is, you know, this nation leading carbon market, which is going to be a subject of conversation at COP26 is carbon trading and carbon markets at the international level. But, you know, critics have raised concerns that one, the market is not strong enough to reach California's climate goals by 2030, and two, that it allows continued pollution of local communities. So, you know, seeing exactly what California says about its cap and trade program and how other nations and subnational governments respond will be really interesting. Lawmakers have also kind of laid out their plans, including Senator Lena Gonzalez from Long Beach, who said she's really interested in transportation and learning what other governments are doing to clean up the transportation sector, which is California's number one source of greenhouse gas pollution. So really, there's a lot expected to be going on, a lot of conversations to be had, and it'll be really interesting to see how it goes.
David Victor, it sounds like perhaps you're one of the critics of California's carbon trading scheme.
Yeah, I think the carbon trading scheme is a good example of why we need to have a strategy here in California, because we're less than 1% of global emissions. And so what we do here in California matters only insofar as other places around the world learn the right lessons from our experiments. Cap and trade system has really not worked well at all. But we have all kinds of other policies that have had a really big impact, in particular in the electric power sector. We're making massive reductions in emissions from the electric power sector. We're grappling with transportation, and notably through electric vehicles and vehicle charging systems. We're grappling with natural gas, and, you know, the list goes on and on and on and on from that. Almost all of that has come from California doing what it does well, which is figuring out how to work with industry, send the right signals, push down emissions, figure out which experiments work, and so on. Meanwhile, our cap and trade system is there as a kind of layer on top of it. It doesn't really have much of an impact. And some of what we do in our cap and trade system, like trading these offsets where if you're a polluter, you can get a credit for protecting a forest. When you look closely at those offsets programs, and my colleague, Danny Cullenward, has done really some of the best work in this area, has been the lead on this. When you look closely at these offsets programs, what you learn is that they're mainly fraud. They're people playing accounting tricks and things like that. And so we have to be careful as California that when we tell the world what we're doing, we should be telling the world less about our cap and trade system and a lot more about California's industrial policy.
It's so interesting to think about California in this context, in part because we remain a major producer of oil and gas. And I wanted to ask you, Rachel Becker, you know, we have Robert, a listener who writes, what can California do? Many citizens are surprised to learn the state still allows new oil and gas drilling. Ban new drilling now. Is that on the table?
So California is going into this conference with some pretty major news on that front. Just the other week, California Governor Gavin Newsom backed much tougher rules from California's oil and gas regulator about oil and gas development. This is still a draft proposal, But what it says is that new oil and gas wells cannot be drilled within 3,200 feet of what are called sensitive receptors. So schools, nursing homes, homes, hospitals, and other places where sensitive people might be. Also within that 3,200 foot setback zone, existing oil and gas wells will need to have much more stringent environmental controls and monitoring than they do now. That said, again, this is still a draft proposal, so it'll need to wind its way through the regulatory process, and we'll see how it changes as it continues.
Yeah. We're talking about the big 2021 UN climate change meeting, COP26, with David Victor from UC San Diego, Rachel Becker, environment reporter at Cal Matters, Michael Mendez, assistant professor, School of Social Ecology at UC Irvine. I have a listener comment, writes in, Emily in Mountain View says, it'd be great to acknowledge that as a working parent of small children, Governor Newsom may have chosen to support his family in something important over an in-person attendance at a conference. This was a global conference where our state administration is no longer at odds with the federal administration on the topic of climate change. He will still participate virtually, and we have our lieutenant governor in attendance. Not defending Governor Newsom, but I am rather showing this as an example of how we need to support working parents. Point taken. Let's bring in Sven from Palo Alto.
Good morning, everyone. I'm commenting about systemic bias in the building codes as related to electric vehicle charging infrastructure. Specifically, when you build a new single-family home now in California, it has to be EV-capable. It has to be pre-wired to be ready to accept your electric car for charging. When you look at apartments and condos, the current standard is 10%, and the proposed standard right now is 40%. So that means 60% of the people that live in apartments and condos aren't going to be able to get an EV because they're not going to be able to charge at home. And as those who drive EVs, probably 80% of us charge at home because it's cheaper. You can get much cheaper electric rates. It's much more reliable because it's your charger at home, and it's much more convenient because it's your house. You save about $500 a year in driving an EV versus your current ICE car. Yeah. So I see this as a huge environmental problem because, as has already been said, we got to electrify everything. But it's also an equity issue because we're, you know, most people in single-family homes have greater incomes than those in apartments and condos. So we're just, you know, making that divide that much bigger by not allowing people to charge at home.
Thank you so much for that, Sven. Michael Mendez, do you want to address that as an equity issue?
Sure. That's an excellent question and sort of a conflicting issue that community-based groups, particularly environmental justice groups, these are organizations largely representing communities that are low-income and communities of color, have been fighting for and putting this equity and justice lens into California's climate change programs, which often have been very global in scale and geographically neutral, really not really focusing on the hardest hit and the first hit on communities. We see this, as the caller mentioned, from electric vehicles, that the large subsidies were primarily going to wealthy and economically secure households. And so we were subsidizing individuals that didn't need the subsidy. We also saw this in the solar subsidies as well, that it was mainly going to single family homes. And again, with individuals with incomes over $80,000. So the environmental justice group over the years have really withheld their votes in the legislature, and both in terms of legislation and in terms of also the annual budget, because it did not have this environmental justice equity lens. Largely the Latino caucus, Latino legislative caucus, and the African-American caucus were really in pushing the charge to provide more equity in the revenue that we do for climate change investments. And as a question that you made earlier about what is California's role, another caller had a comment that we have the Biden administration, so California really doesn't have much of an influence at the national level or the global stage, but California really does in terms of how we lead with these equity principles. As the fifth largest economy, the things that we do are scaled up other places. We see this in the Justice 40 agenda, the climate agenda that the Biden administration has and is pushing forward.
Can you tell us a little more about that and like California's role in that?
Yes. So the Justice 40 is a fundamental shift, really bringing off of the Green New Deal principles of putting at least 40% of all climate investments in disadvantaged or environmental justice communities. That means low-income and low-income communities of color that are first and hardest hit by climate change impacts, both in terms of local pollution, as well as impacts of wildfires, extreme weather events, and ensuring that we're not only providing mitigation opportunities, but also climate adaptation, adapting these communities, these socially vulnerable communities, ahead of time before they can prepare for our changing climate. So that 40% was directly derived after the many years that the environmental justice group were fighting essentially with largely white coastal Democrats and mainstream environmental groups like the Environmental Defense Fund, NRDC, the National Resources Defense Fund, that did not in the early years want to put an equity lens and have a dedicated amount or floor of climate investments in environmental justice communities. So in my book, Climate Change from American Streets, I really chronicle that history and that conflict and eventually collaboration that that forced the governor's office and various administrations and, of course, the legislature to have a more equity focus on climate change. And we see this again with the Biden administration adopting the the Justice 40 initiative.
Who do you see, you know, at that subnational, as they like to say in climate things, you know, states, cities, other, you know, provinces and other places? Who are sort of California's allies in using that sort of equity lens?
I would say on the West Coast, of course, we have Washington State and Oregon. Washington is probably the biggest leader on the West Coast trying to put forward a justice equity lens. Their climate change ballots have failed in previous years because they did not include labor and environmental justice organizations when they drafted those state ballot measures. So they have learned from those experiences, have really looked and had conversations with policymakers and environmental justice organizations in California to understand how we did it in California. And I know that there's similar talks that have been going on with New York. I was actually at the National Association of Latino Elected Officials this past week, where I was giving a talk on climate-induced disasters to Latino elected officials from all over the country. And I was sitting next to a representative from the state of New York, who's the chair of the Senate Labor Committee, and talking about the influence California has had in terms of addressing climate-induced disasters and, of course, climate mitigation. So New York, a couple years ago, passed a comprehensive program and that actually kind of looks like the suite of climate policies and programs that California has enacted over the last 18 years.
Hey, David Victor, Amy, listener, tweets, any chance you could be the one news outlet that doesn't talk in code? You could actually say what 1.5 degrees means. 1.5 degrees more than what baseline? Just in our 30 seconds before the break here, maybe you could give us that quick breakdown.
Sure. 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. And that's just the benchmark that's used in almost all the climate models.
Yeah. And pre-industrial levels pegged to sort of what? Times.
Yeah, the end of the 19th century, roughly. There's some different baselines, but when you take a step back and look at the temperature data, it's like a hockey stick turned on its side. Temperature is highly variable over history, and then starting with the explosion of the Industrial Revolution and the emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, temperatures have been rising very, very rapidly ever since then.
We're talking about COP26, the latest UN climate change meeting, with David Victor, professor of innovation and public policy at UC San Diego, Rachel Becker, environment reporter with Cal Matters, and Michael Mendez, assistant professor in the School of Social Ecology at UC Irvine and author of Climate Change from the Streets, How Conflict and Collaboration Strengthen the Environmental Justice Movement. We really do want to hear from you. How can California be a model for global climate policy? And is California doing enough to reduce its carbon footprint? Give us a call now, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or you can email your questions and comments to forum@kqed.org. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for more Forum after the break.
This is Barbara Leslie, president of the Oakland Port Commission. Oakland International Airport, OAK, is proud to bring you this podcast of KQED's Forum. When you're choosing your next adventure, the smart and convenient choice is to fly the East Bay Way from OAK to destinations across the USA and Mexico. And when you return home, tune in to KQED, always bringing us remarkable stories about who we are and where we live. Enjoy today's episode of Forum.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees, who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking about COP26, the latest UN climate change meeting. We've got Michael Mendez from UC Irvine, Rachel Becker from Cal Matters, and David Victor from UC San Diego. David Victor, Shana in Oakland has some pushback for you. She writes, David Victor said that the offsets used in California cap and trade are mainly fraud. I know that offsets are a complicated concept. It's never possible to fully prove a counterfactual, but I'd love to hear his evidence because that was a very steep claim. To question offsets that individuals or companies purchase is one thing, but those of the whole state's flagship program. Cap and Trade and the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund have provided funding for countless investments across the state, such as EV charging infrastructure, bike amenities that help people get out of their cars, and much more.
Yeah, so the two separate issues there. One is what's done with the money from the auctions that sell these emission credits. And exactly, she says that money is used for lots of purposes, some worthy. And you have to pay really close attention to where the money flows. And frankly, we need better controls over that so we maximize the value from that. Danny Cullenward, who I mentioned earlier, and I have a book out called Making Climate Policy Work, which looks at the world experience with these cap and trade systems and focuses a lot on where the money goes. On the question of the fraud, that's, I think, really the dark news here. And there's been a huge amount of research in this area. I would draw your listeners' attention to a series of articles that James Temple from Technology Review, which is a flagship publication from MIT, has published over the last year. If you just search for Technology Review, you'll find
longtime climate reporter. Yeah.
Yeah, and extremely knowledgeable, very, very careful reporting. And then there's a piece in the Los Angeles Times that looks at one of the flagship forests that was used to generate offsets that then burned, and people still use the offsets. And so you have all the emissions that were credited back in the atmosphere, and the companies that use the offsets are still emitting, still causing the emissions for which they claim the offsets were covering. So I think it's actually a pretty dark story out there, and we got to remember that as California, we're proud of our leadership, but the whole game on climate is not leadership, it's followership. It's getting others to do things that really matter, and our cap and trade program is not a good model.
I mean, one thing that kind of spins out of this forming an adjacent issue. I mean, the U.S. and EU announced this bilateral deal to encourage emissions reductions in steel. And analysts kind of explaining the substance of that in the Washington Post noted how much climate action now is contained in those kind of deals. And one of their points was that the push to really set a price on carbon, whether it was just a straight up price or some kind of cap and trade system, had largely failed. And so more of these kind of sectoral approaches going after, you know, transportation, going after particular industrial processes, that was really what was having more impact now. And my question about this is pricing carbon in this way that, you know, economists have been suggesting for decades, is that really just a failed strategy at this point? Are we actually not going to do that?
I think it's part of the strategy. So pricing works well when everybody knows what the best technologies are and what they cost, and what you're doing is using the market to help firms optimize their choices. And that, in that kind of setting, a well-designed pricing system can play a significant role. Almost everything that's really interesting when it comes to making big reductions in emissions isn't like that. It's like the example of steel and aluminum, the deal that was announced over the weekend between the United States and the EU, where the alternatives are so much more expensive and complex and risky than the existing products that you can't expect the price effects alone to get firms to go off and make the investments in the experiments. You've got to go work sector by sector and figure out which technology technologies actually are viable or not, learn quickly, and then scale those up. And that's exactly what that deal is going to do. It's the most important climate news this week, compared with all the talking in COP26, which we'll be talking. And then people, when they're done talking, will be done talking. Whereas this will be a lasting bilateral arrangement.
You know, Rachel Becker, we asked people sort of what can California do? And I'm going to read a little group of these comments from listeners. And I wanted to just ask you, you know, is California actually on its path to doing some of these things from your reporting? So we've got Bill, a simple thing California can do. Don't shut down Diablo Canyon nuclear plant, which produces about as much clean power as all the solar panels installed in the last several years. Chris in Modesto writes, California could begin a program where states could partner with countries on the front line, sharing technology, et cetera, like we do with firefighters. A listener tweets, California has one of the lowest oil severance taxes in the country, less than 1%. Texas charges 7.5%. Seems like a no-brainer to increase this tax, but I never hear our representatives talk about it. And Eric in Menlo Park writes, is there an effort to ban use of two-cycle gasoline engines, such as lawnmowers and leaf blowers in the state? With cleaner cars, these devices are now a significant source of the state's air pollution, but there doesn't seem to be the political will to ban them. So a little a menu of options, Rachel.
My goodness. Okay. There are a lot of things to address there. I mean, it's a great question what California is going to look like when it's post-nuclear. You know, the loss of nuclear power plants will mean California has to replace them with something. And, you know, it's not looking like it's going to be hydropower, given how inconsistent California's rainfall is. And, you know, the projections that with climate change, we're going to see, you know, more kind of whiplash between drought and deluge. So that's a really something I think California is grappling with right now. It's something that the California Legislative Analyst's Office has looked at. About sharing technologies with other frontline communities. California has interacted with other governments, you know, with delegations, including from China, about its climate and clean air policies. You know, it's a great question about where those are going and mm-hmm. How those will carry through into the COP26 conference. For lawnmowers and leaf blowers, there was some action at the legislative level on this. So we'll see how that plays out.
Yeah, cool. Thank you so much. You've amazing grasp on what's happening in this state. Meredith from San Jose, welcome to the show.
I was just calling in to share some information about what's happening in San Jose right now, which
is cool. Thank you.
The City Charter Review Commission is proposing a resident, indigenous, and scientist-led climate crisis action commission into the city charter. It would be the first of its kind in California. There's one in Honolulu. There are a lot of other citizen led organ policy initiatives in other cities, but this would be the first in California at the charter level. It would be a permanent commission to take ideas like those other listeners just called in with and craft them into policy that the city council has to act on within 90 days. The City Charter Review Commission is also proposing a police oversight board in the City Charter of San Jose. In the next couple of weeks, the city council will vote on it, and hopefully next year, San Jose will get a chance to add that to our city charter to make policy and oversight and community communication on a small scale change like those people are calling in about a reality,
Meredith,
in San Jose.
Yeah, Meredith, what's your role? How did you get involved in this kind of organizing?
Last week, I spoke at the City Charter Review Commission, and there's an article in the Merc from this Sunday about the efforts of the Charter Review to get this kind of board in our permanent community, so that policy and Indigenous voices can be lifted up in how we operate as a city, not just on that big granular level. Like San Jose has a great clean energy commission that's working on electrification, but things like water reclamation, waste management, food security, open spaces, and urban farming, those are all things that there's a lot of work to be done on.
Meredith, Ian, you know, for someone who's working the way you are, really like in the nitty gritty of like making this work at the city level,
I mean, do you need anything from COP26? Or are you just sort of like, you know what, we have the solutions we need and we have the policy framework that we'd like to institute. And like those negotiations can go however they go, but we're going to keep working here.
Yeah, I don't think whatever comes out of COP26 is going to change what's happening municipally. Maybe at the state level, and that'd be great. Sort of like that two-cycle engine, leaf blowers and lawnmowers that somebody was calling in about. There's also an initiative made with a working group from Councilmember Matt Mahan making leaf blowers a thing of the past in San Jose as well. It's going to phase in, and I think it's already passed or it's close.
Yeah. Hey, Meredith, thanks so much. That's a great update from San Jose. Michael Mendez, I'd like to hear from you. I mean, it sounds to me like this is exactly the kind of local activism with the kind of lenses that you have sort of been pushing for.
What the caller just talked about, this people-centered, community-led approach, is so exciting to hear. And because time and time again, my research and others from around the world have showed that climate action fundamentally starts with passionate, courageous individuals at the local scale experimenting around climate solutions and problems and enacting them. And then those are seen by other regions as being successful, and they start to gain saliency and legitimacy and are validated throughout the world. So climate action really does start at the neighborhood local scale. And it's also important what the San Jose is doing, and other communities like Richmond, Oakland, and New York City have really led and providing more diverse voices and going away from this abstract, only expert or economic lens, and providing the influence and lived experience of people that are on the front lines and living next to the Chevron refinery in Richmond or here in, or down south in Wilmington, and really bringing them into those spaces to talk about how climate change is impacting the health of their communities, their children, and enacting that into our climate change solutions. So time and time again, research has shown when you put that public health lens on climate action and its messaging and its policies, a multi-benefit, co-benefits focus on health, economic, and social, you have more saliency and more impact around the world. And it's quite concerning being here at COP, you know, walking around. It's a very expensive process to be here. And there, you know, I'm Latino, and there's very few people that are Black and brown at this community. So that's another issue at COP globally, the access to diverse voices and expertise from around the world, particularly island states and those communities, those countries in the global South that are also at the front lines. So that's another concern being here at COP and seeing that a lack of diversity from people of color from developing countries.
Yeah. You know, David Victor, we've been talking a lot about sort of the intercommunal aspects of this, you know, at the kind of subnational level. And we've also been talking about kind of the global level. I do want to ask you about what we should make of Biden's framework for a prospective deal with Democrats, which seems at the national level like it could have, say, $500 trillion in various types of investments and tax incentives around climate action. What's your take on it?
My take is it's a big deal. It's $500 trillion plus or minus. You know, when you have this quantity of money, it's a little hard to keep track of all of it. It's, depending on how you count, five times larger than any single climate bill in history. So it's a really big deal. I think the president, when he's in Glasgow, is going to discover that on the one hand, he's doing a lot at home. On the other hand, the rest of the world isn't quite sure what to believe, because he's going to cut U.S. emissions 50% by 2030. This bill probably won't get there. The modeling is pretty hard to do, but I don't think the modeling suggests that we're going to get there. And then on top of it, the rest of the world is not just paying attention to what we're going to do in terms of controlling emissions, but also paying attention to the U.S. contributions to international funding around climate change. There was a big pledge made going back to 2009 for $100 billion of new climate-related money per year by about now. And the world, the rich countries are about 80% of the way there. Germany and Canada are stepping up to the plate just over the last few days and are going to help fill in some of the missing parts. The president made a big announcement at the UN that the US would be making big contributions, but we don't have the money because we don't have the support in Congress, in part because the nation is divided. And so that whole problem of on the one hand, announcing that we're back, and on the other hand, the rest of the world not really knowing what we can deliver and watching our newspapers as this whole messy political debate unfolds inside the United States, that's very harmful to the U.S. position in the world.
Yeah, I mean, I have a hard time imagining that like a hard-nosed Chinese or European technocrat could look at the American system right now and see a trustworthy climate partner. I mean,
and the Chinese, the Chinese head of state is not going. He also didn't go to COP. To the G20 meetings over the weekend. Our relationships with China are in tatters. That's a big problem because we're the two biggest emitters. And so if you go back in history to the years before the Paris Agreement in 2015, it was what the US and China did pledge to each other bilaterally that helped set the tone for what was achievable in Paris. None of that is happening right now. There's a little bit of happening in the kind of margins in a quiet way, but none of that kind of big strategic relationship with the other big economy in the world is happening. And that's a big problem.
Yeah. Let's bring in one last caller, Arthur from Corte Madera.
Hello there.
Hey, Arthur.
Great program, as usual.
Thank you.
I'd like to recommend three organizations in Marin County which are living up to the notion of Marin being a exceptionally environmentally oriented community. The first is the Marin Environmental Forum, which for, I think, about 42 years has been teaching the ins and outs and nuances of environmental policy at virtually all levels. It's a training class, goes on for a number of weeks, and which you take tests, and which basically is the equivalent of going to Berkeley to learn environmentalism. Another organization is called Resilient Neighborhoods, which sets up a checklist of what an individual can do to improve their environmental contribution by their own behavior, so that you get together. It's frequently started in a library. You join with other people. You trade suggestions on how to save, conserve, or do a right action over time. And then over the period of time the, quote, class goes on, you compare where you started and where you're ending. It's exceptional. And it can be done anywhere. In other words, you don't have to be physically present to go to a class in Marin.
We're running out of time. Arthur, just wanted to give people the shout out. That's Environmental Forum and Resilient Neighborhoods. Rachel Becker, I wanted to give you the last word here around California and sort of what you expect. If you expect when our delegation gets back from COP26, do you think anything will be different or policymaking will change?
That's a really good question, and it's difficult to predict the future. You know, I know that California's lawmakers were looking forward to having conversations, you know, among themselves and among the California delegation in response to many of these sessions. It kind of gives them an opportunity to chat, have these focused conversations about climate and climate policy. So we may see something coming out of this, but you know, it really remains to be seen how the discussions go, you know, what California's lawmakers and top officials learn. I think that, you know, we'll just have to watch how this plays out.
Yeah. Thank you so much. We have been talking about the big 2021 UN climate change meeting. That's COP26, which began on Sunday. We've been joined by Rachel Becker, very excellent environment reporter with Cal Matters, David Victor, professor of innovation and public policy with the School of Global Policy and Strategy at UC San Diego, and an adjunct professor in climate, atmospheric science, and physical oceanography at Scripps. He'll be attending COP26 as part of the UC delegation. And finally, Michael Mendez, assistant professor at the School of Social Ecology at UC Irvine and author of Climate Change from the Streets, How Conflict and Collaboration Strengthen the Environmental Justice Movement. And he's already in Scotland. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum Ahead with Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.
This is Barbara Leslie, president of the Oakland Port Commission. Oakland International Airport, OAK, is proud to bring you this podcast of KQED's Forum. When you're choosing your next adventure, the smart and convenient choice is to fly the East Bay Way from OAK to destinations across the USA and Mexico. And when you return home, tune in to KQED, always bringing us remarkable stories about who we are and where we live. Enjoy today's episode of Forum.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.